Good morning, everybody. Happy hump day, happy Wednesday, and welcome to the Bitcoin Veteran Spaces, episode 141. I am your host, Coleman, and today we are joined by a special guest, Ken from the BPI, Bitcoin Policy Institute. So he's going to be joining us today. Give me one second. Let me see. Bob, give me a thumbs up if you're able to come up here and talk today. I'd like to get you up here on the panel. I do want to say good morning to Steve, Wade on the Bitcoin Alaska, IT Iote, Jesse, 21 million, Rogan. Who else do we have? We had Pedro, Toasty, Abe, Design, Positive, Hunter, and of course, our guest, Ken. Good morning, sir. How are you doing?
Good morning, Coleman. I'm good. How's everybody today?
Yeah, I can't speak for everybody else, but I am doing fantastic.
Awesome.
It's a great week.
I'll tell you, we're in Washington, D.C., we get about 3 weeks of spring, and it's like it kicked off yesterday. So in about 3 weeks, it'll be hot and swampy, but we are in it. It is beautiful. It's actually quite a pleasant change.
Yeah, there's something about all that, you know, the bright, vivid colors of the green, all the flowers blooming. It's nice. We have that down here in South Texas right now, except we're at that point where we get that green haze from all the pollen just kind of floating around. Yeah. We need some rain down south so we can knock that down. But Ken, let's go ahead and start rolling into this. If you don't mind, for the listeners who are unaware, can you tell us just a little bit about yourself and what you do at BPI?
Sure. So I started at BPI actually. Monday was my 1 month anniversary. What a time to start. Executive order, our conference on March 11th. But yeah, I got into Bitcoin. I've been on the show with you guys before. I'm a retired CIA officer. I spent a lot of my career overseas, and I got into Bitcoin while I was working at our cyber center. And that was, you know, 2018, 2019. And by 2020, I jumped off the precipice and deep down the rabbit hole. When I left government service, I worked at a small tech company for a couple of years, a really, really great team. In January, when Dave and Grant from BPI, I had dinner with them and they proposed coming over to BPI to head up government affairs, I couldn't say no. I really would have dream job. So it's been a month. It's been an absolutely insane month, in a good way. But what a great change. And it's really, I mean, it's just what a pleasure to be able to work in the Bitcoin policy space right now.
Yeah, it's kind of a perfect time to get in there. Everything is just running at 100%. My first question was, did the Trump administration reach out to BPI, with the creation or the wording of the Strategic Bitcoin Reserve?
Well, I think you've seen our products. BPI has been putting out, policy products on the SBR and other Bitcoin products for a long time. So I think we probably shouldn't take credit for the wording of the EO. But I do think on the thought leadership side, Pines and Grant, deserve a lot of credit because this has been a month long project, right? The SBR was originally conceived, you know, last summer, as a thought project for how the U.S. government can solve its debt problem and also how it can, take steps to participate in an evolving global monetary system. And lo and behold, 1 month ago, you know, the U.S. government officially took on its books an asset that didn't even exist 17 years ago, which for me is an incredible step. And so I think BPI deserves a lot of, I 1 month into it, I would love to pat myself on the back and say, yeah, you're welcome. Not me. But I do think BPI deserves a lot of credit for the thought leadership that they've exhibited over the past, not just the past 6 months, but even for the past since 2020, when this project started, in framing policy expectations and the debate around Bitcoin.
Yeah, that's awesome. I think you give yourself some credit, Ken. I think all Bitcoiners can give themselves credit for getting this.
I'll take credit wherever I can get it.
Yeah, I think if you've had a conversation with anybody about Bitcoin, you're helping the cause, right? As long as you're framing it in a positive light and you're being friendly about it. But yeah, I think all of that is those small little pebbles that start coming down the mountainside that create a big avalanche that, you know, gets this for me right now. So I do want to pick your brain a little bit, if you can,
sure.
About the wording of the strategic Bitcoiners that Trump did with the executive order. I think Bitcoiners are pretty split on it. Some think it's a great way to try and add Bitcoin in a budget neutral way. And others think that, that's horrible, they're just going to try and confiscate it from people and it's not done right. So what are your thoughts on that? I'm more pro that they're mentioning it. This is a good sign. So that's kind of where I sit.
I think generally speaking, I think we have to be, when we talk about, there's sort of two prongs of the discussion, right? There's like, should the U.S. government have Bitcoin? That sort of basic fundamental decision, and then how to pay for it. And, there are a lot of fiscal hawks in Congress, frankly, with the White House, that are very, very cautious about how we spend taxpayer dollars and the perception of, sort of favoring a certain industry or interest group. I think the way that the president's initial step, was quite productive, again, because the U.S. government, as many of you all know, is one of the largest Bitcoin holders in the world. It was a very reasonable first step to ask federal agencies to take a tally of how much Bitcoin they actually have on their balance sheets, and then to declare that we're not going to sell it, that these are now not just property of the U.S. government, but they are actually part of our balance sheet, part of our national wealth, so to speak. So I think that was a very reasonable first step for President Trump. And again, it avoided some of the pitfalls of the discussions about budget, which are, I think, probably better served legislatively in Congress. And I think, Senator Lummis reintroduced her Bitcoin Act at our conference on March 11th, and that proposes some ways of funding we can discuss. But I think for the initial step, I think what we really needed was sort of a national declaration that Bitcoin is a strategic asset. And I think almost not maybe equally importantly, but also that it differentiates Bitcoin from other cryptos. I think part of the problem we face on the policy side for years, and even before working at BPI, we talked about this in the past. I worked with the Club for Growth and did advocacy on the Hill, meeting with staffers and members of Congress to talk about Bitcoin and why it's good for America. But this executive order codifies as policy that Bitcoin is different. I think it's important. As we saw, there was a little bit of competition in the new year, right? The larger crypto industry spent a lot of money in elections last year. Some supporting Republicans, a lot supporting Democrats. So there was some discussion about, how that was going to play out on the policy side, but ultimately truth bore itself out. And the president declared that our policy now is that Bitcoin is separate and unique. And there are aspects of that bill that deal with sort of the larger crypto ecosystem, but not as strategic assets. I think that was a critical distinction. And I think that lays a groundwork for a good discussion about what the next steps are for the United States and its Bitcoin policy.
Yeah, definitely. So then let's just roll into it. Like what are the next steps? Which direction are they going to go?
It was very interesting. Y'all should follow Bo Hines on Twitter. He's up in New York this week. He gave a great talk about the SPR, and he reiterated that the president's policy is that we want more Bitcoin. And when somebody asked him how much, he said it's kind of like gold or money, right? You always want more. If you can get more, you take more. And Bo Hines is in the White House. He's David Sachs' right hand man on the working group. So when Bo Hines speaks, I think we can take that as White House intent, which is great. And as you all know, Senator Lummis reintroduced her bill. She's got several co-sponsors, the Bitcoin Act, and a companion bill has been introduced in the House by Congressman Begich from Alaska, who everybody should also follow. I think he's going to be a great leader in this space, to actually finance the purchase of Bitcoin for the balance sheet. And that's where we are now. It's the Bitcoin Act.
Okay. And I'm going to backtrack just a little bit on this. Sure. What about with the crypto stockpile? Why is that important? Because in there they say that they have no plans of purchasing more of that crap. And I took it as they plan on selling that to kind of fund the SPR. Am I right in that take, or am I completely off the mark?
So I don't think that's been really specified. Again, the government, just through criminal actions, and the government has a lot of crypto. And so I think the first step is they have to figure out how much they have. I don't think there's actually been a concrete decision about how that's going to be disposed. From our perspective, it makes sense. I was talking to a Hill staffer just last week, asking about it, and said, well, if the government needs more Ripple, they can just call Ripple and have it print it. So, is that strategic? No, I don't think so. But I think the first step is for the government to figure out how much crypto they actually we actually have in federal in government possession, and then they can figure out this position. And it's very possible that that becomes part of the discussion for the Bitcoin Act as well.
Was that a legitimate headline that the U.S. Marshals Service really can't figure out where all the Bitcoin is? Like it was just on an Excel spreadsheet?
I think the Marshals Service probably has a good idea because everything they control is through legal process, right? If you, of course, the largest portion of that are old Silk Road coins, right? Some of Russell Brooks coins, Jimmy Zhang, another Silk Road related case that, I think the government got 50,000 Bitcoin from that. And then, throughout the years, there are criminal cases where the government takes control. So I think that the Marshals Service probably has a good idea, just because everything it gets from legal is from legal process. So I'd like to imagine that there is some kind of process in place that allows them to track that. Hopefully better than a spreadsheet. But you never know; it could just be there a bunch of ledgers in a drawer somewhere. But hopefully not. But again, the U.S. government is, as any veteran knows, is vast and wide. How much Bitcoin is sitting, throughout DOD, for example? Who knows? I don't think anybody knows. And I think it's a bigger task than it sounds. Very easy for the White House to tell to ask agencies, how much do you have? But then these agencies, remember, the crypto has been sort of part of the sort of national security ecosystem for a long time, 10 years, track it all down. How many federal agencies survive audits, right? Now you got to find Bitcoin. I think it's probably a slightly more complicated task than I think it sounds. Just tell us how much you have. I think of all the agencies, the Marshals probably have the best grip on it because again, at least there's like legal paperwork to say, okay, we are now giving you X amount of Bitcoin because of this case. Your job is to take it and custody it and then dispose of it as policymakers direct you to do. Are you still there?
Some thumbs up if you guys can hear me. Don't see many thumbs. Bear with us while we try to sort out the tech. All right, there's some thumbs. Getting like a delay here with the space hearing myself talk like 20 seconds after I'm speaking, so I'll try not to ramble too much, but I don't know, Coleman, we might have to restart the space here. All right, I'm gonna just have to take off my headphones here to speak, otherwise I'm gonna be stumbling over my own words. So it looks like, we have Coleman back up here. Coleman, you want to try speak and see if it's working for you?
Can you guys hear me now? Hello to the void. Can anybody hear me? There we go.
Yeah, I hear you. I just also hear myself speaking like 20 seconds delayed, so it's super weird. So I'm going to try to drop actually as well and then come back on because that's tough.
Yeah, feel free to drop off. I don't know what's going on.
Hey guys, something happened. We back?
I can hear you, Ken. Can you hear me?
Great. Yes, gotcha. Oh, excellent.
Sorry, I just had to fix some audio things. So I have no idea what my question was or where we left off.
We were talking about the whether the Marshals, how much, whether we know if the Marshals Service actually has everything they say they have, and what that looks like, trying to have the government provide an accounting. I'm not sure where we might have gotten lost. But yeah, again, I think the Marshal Service of all the agencies probably has a good idea just because of the nature of how they acquire it. They don't get it. It's given to them through legal process. So theoretically, there's paperwork. The rest of the government, who knows? We'll find out.
Yeah, I guess we'll find out with time with that. So I know you're pretty, you said you've been here for a month with BPI, but what are some of the misconceptions that you're finding lawmakers have about Bitcoin? Are they still just lumping it in together with crypto, or are they just hesitant because, you know, they've seen the tops and the bottoms and the big drawdowns, or they just hear the rhetoric from Elizabeth Warren type that just says for criminals?
So I think that the distinction in the EO between Bitcoin and crypto was actually very, very instructive for a lot of lawmakers. My experience has been, and this is over the past month, but even before kind of talking to lawmakers and policymakers about this, there's always been a small cadre of strong supporters, the Senator Lummises of the world, and there's always been a small cadre of haters. It was the Elizabeth Warrens and the Brad Shermans of the world. But up for grabs has always been the vast middle, and I found that vast middle was mostly either just ambivalent or just uninformed about the space. And I think that over the past year, as sort of the industry emerged as a political force, people started to pay attention. And I've been really, really impressed by the kinds of discussions I've had with staffers and regulators who have spent the time, put the work in to study and learn about the space and figure out, you know, what they need to know about it and whether it's something they want to support. So I think that has changed radically over the past month. And I think the president's EO deserves a lot of credit for that, because also it forces a discussion with lawmakers, right? The president, you know, issues an order, and politicians on both sides now need to have an opinion on it because they're going to get asked. My experience has been, I was just up on the Hill yesterday and talking with some staffers. These are deeply experienced people that just haven't been exposed to the space before, but really incredible questions. And it actually made me feel good because it shows that there are people in government thinking deeply about this space, which I think is very, very important. But I think that's just a function of the sort of historical ambivalence, maybe over the past couple of years. But the ambivalence that most politicians have felt toward Bitcoin, they just hadn't had to deal with it before. Now they have to. What we're trying to do at Bitcoin Policy Institute is avoid Bitcoin becoming a partisan issue. The president has been a great leader on this issue. Can't thank him enough. It's our view though that Bitcoin is, as I think most people agree, is for everyone and anyone. And we are now trying to make the case across party aisles that this legislation, the SBR, and everything associated with encouraging Bitcoin adoption in the United States is good for everybody. It's not just good for Republicans. It's not just good for Democrats. It's good for everybody. And that's really a focus of our efforts right now. I've been personally impressed by the receptivity so far.
Well, that's good to hear. What tactics are you using though to make this so both sides of the aisle can kind of see clearly and they're not just, you know, clouded with the fog and the hatred for them left or right?
Yeah. So, I mean, every lawmaker has their own interests, right? It's not pandering. It's just speaking to the things they care about. There are deficit hawks that want to know that this is going to help solidify the long-term economic prospects of the United States. There are progressives who want to know this is good for traditionally disenfranchised groups and it's good for inclusion. There are libertarians who want to know that this empowers individuals to private property. And to control their own wealth. So there's a whole spectrum of areas where different lawmakers are interested, and you kind of speak to those. You kind of try to speak to those. My experience has been that there's a lot of focus on the debt is obviously an important topic of discussion right now. So there's a lot of discussion about how we do this in a debt neutral way, but also how's it good for America? Because again, I think a lot of politicians, especially people just in the space, their experience with a lot of Bitcoiners has been sort of like crypto anarchy, you know, burn down the Fed. And a lot of them just, you know, that's a bit much for some of them to take. So we talked about how actually, you know, Bitcoin can actually be constructive for the United States. That's been a central focus of our work, on the national security side, and also just for overall economic development. So, but again, you want to know who you're talking to. Each legislator has their own sort of areas of interest. They're humans, like the rest of us. And you take those pieces of those parts of the Bitcoin ecosystem that speak to those, and you emphasize those. And you don't hide anything. But you give them sort of you walk them through how Bitcoin helps things that are specific concern to them. And that really at least gets their attention. It at least gets you an audience and a fair discussion. At the end of the day, politicians, the lawmakers have a lot of competing interests, a lot of competing time requests. That's really all you can ask for is a fair hearing, right?
So I have a question for you.
Sure.
I'm confused with the stance that or the argument that we're making that if we start, you know, the SBR and we start accumulating Bitcoin and we want to get to 1 million, let's say the Lummis bill, it gets passed and we hold on to it. It's going to help reduce the deficit. To me, that doesn't make sense. Why would we acquire Bitcoin to go ahead and pay off the debt? Because then we're back to square one again. We're going to keep continuing to rack up these deficits and we'll start having debt and we have no more Bitcoin. So what, is that how we're trying to get the ball across the line, by showing this, but then in the end, we know we're not going to sell Bitcoin? I guess that's where I'm kind of confused.
I think a lot of it is what does the balance sheet look like, right? Like your credit rating is really kind of like, it's not necessarily how much cash you have, is what your balance sheet rate look like. What are your assets versus your debts versus your liabilities? And I think the thought being that if you add Bitcoin in a constructive way to the balance sheet, it's good for your balance sheet, right? Bitcoin will appreciate in price. That's our contention over the next 10 years, 20 years, 30 years. And that, along with fiscal restraint, will improve improve your balance sheet outlook. I think a lot of the, discussion, this is, I think, the rationale for in Lummis bill is the revaluation of gold certificates. You know, we hope the gold was in Fort Knox. It's currently valued at $40 an ounce. We look far and wide to figure out why exactly that happened. There's a lot of sort of speculation as to why the government's done that. But if you revalue gold to its current market value, we'll call it $3,000, you can take, that gives the treasury more spending power and they can use that to acquire Bitcoin. The Lummis bill sets out 1 million as a starting point, but with every piece of legislation, right, that's subject to negotiation, I think, on the end. But I think the larger argument for why we want to acquire it is more, from my perspective, it's more, I mean, I think the balance sheet is important. It's frankly very important, but it's really a national security foreign policy, also a national security foreign policy issue. Again, as I frame this when I talk to people who are, you know, especially Hill staffers that are sort of new to the space, you know, you lay out sort of the evolution of the current system where we are. If you look back to like, let's just pick, I always pick like 1960 is a good date. Just because it's sort of after was really the consolidation of the post-war world. I think 1960 is fair enough. You could pick any date you want. 1960, there were less than 100 members of the United Nations. US was 40% of GDP. 1971, we sort of soft defaulted on our debt and we unpegged from the gold standard. And today, there are 190 something members of the United Nations and US is 24% of GDP and that at the global GDP. And that GDP is different, right? In 1960, we built a lot of things. Today we don't. So necessarily the system that evolved, that was born in that post-war world is going to evolve. And I think there's a lot of struggle in Washington DC to get their head around like what that might look like. As again, people in the space know since 9/11, the tools at the government's disposal to use the dollar as a tool for national security, financial surveillance have all ballooned. The number of treasury sanctions has increased by 1,000% since 2001. So there's an establishment in Washington D.C. that has just gotten used to using the dollar, the system as a tool of foreign policy. And when you kind of walk them through a scenario, how that's going to change, how that sword has become blunted over years, you know, it takes a couple iterations to get people to think about it. And it's, I think, but I think people on the national security side see it. China is leading an effort to build a parallel system. The Bagger National Settlements is building, has worked with the Chinese to build the Enbridge system, which is a interconnected CBDC system. China has their SIPS program, which is their way of facilitating international payments outside the SWIFT system. You know, our adversaries are adapting to the world we've built. And it's going to change. And necessarily, when you've gone from 40% of global GDP to 24% of global GDP, the influence you have over the system is going to evolve and change. And I think the emergence of a global neutral asset is inevitable. Gold plays that role. I tell people, like, gold is, it's 5,000 years old. It's in our genes, right? It's in our skin. Now, humans have just an inherent attraction to it. And it's, I think it'll always play a role. But gold is really, as we all know, not optimized for the modern world. The modern world is digital. Bitcoin is digital gold, and so on some level, it's optimized for digital world. And so, if countries are looking for alternatives to holding treasuries, to holding assets that are within the reach of a foreign power, they're going to look for assets taken self custody, but that also play well in the digital world. And this is why global sovereign wealth funds all across the world, in the Middle East, even in Europe, are buying Bitcoin because they see it. They look at the charts, and they like the appreciation over a certain time horizon. But they also see it as an asset that they can custody by themselves. It doesn't have to sit in London. It doesn't have to sit in a JP Morgan vault in New York City. They can custody it themselves. They can put it in their balance sheet. They can safely expect appreciation over time. And it allows them to play with it allows them to interact with whatever camps emerge in the new global financial system. So I think that if that system is going to evolve, I think it is. And I think, these people thinking about national security see it's going to evolve. It's inevitable. It's almost inevitable. We should be looking to lay a stake and to be a dominant player and an important piece of that new system. And I think an important piece of that new system is going to be Bitcoin.
Yeah, I think you're 100% right with that. Do you think though that our enemies or even our allies realize the importance of not just Bitcoin, but the block space, like creating just like a nationwide hash force to go ahead and secure the block space? I know Bob Burnett is really big about this with barefoot mining. And he says that's going to be the next race in the coming years. Do you feel like that's going to start happening sooner than that? Or do you still think we're quite a few years out before nations understand the importance of securing that block space?
I think the block space discussion is definitely 2.0 next level discussion, with policymakers. I think, but there is a lot of interest in access to energy. I rely on anecdotes. I have a lot of friends, who are, out the fringes in Africa, making deals with foreign power providers, to get access to cheap power, in return for dollars. And, you know, it's a way for African countries, for example, to subsidize their grid. And they told me, you know, when they go to a meeting, they're on their way in, the person coming out is Chinese, probably from Bitmain, right? Or when they're coming out, the person sitting in the lobby is Chinese. There's a lot of competition on the continent. This is one example on the continent for access to power. When you layer stakes in places, where there's cheap power, where the natural resources, you know, that brings influence. And there is a race in emerging markets in developing countries, certainly across Africa, to lay those first stakes, and to build relationships with foreign power providers and with these governments. And hence, you know, and theoretically you gain national advantage in that. And I think people are receptive to that argument. This is beyond, you know, sort of in addition to what the advantages Bitcoin can offer, you know, our own grid. In terms of laying claim to power sources and resources abroad, you know, the Chinese have been using Bitcoin mining for years to do that. We have some really good, smart, highly motivated people on the U.S. side who are doing the same thing. But it's a global competition, right? And I think these countries, I mean, I think your first blush, they see the dollar signs, right? They this is a way to bring hard currency into the economies. But also the smart ones, you know, see the appreciation of Bitcoin, and they see it as a way of as a building block for whatever plans they have for building their own economies. But I think that the block space discussion is kind of next level. I don't think we're there yet. I think it's more a question of how Bitcoin mining Bitcoin and Bitcoin miners help us stake claims, build relationships in different parts of the world that will benefit the United States.
Okay. I'm going to ask you a question about Michelle Weekly. I'm not sure if you're familiar with her. She made a post just a couple of days ago about, and it kind of gained a lot of traction on Bitcoin Twitter. She said she thinks the DOD is going to start mining Bitcoin. She started reposting Saylor's tweets about big things are coming, Matthew Pines with the room where it all started, and then Jason Lowry tweet about give it about 3 weeks and it should become more obvious. So do you think that we will get an announcement in a month that the DOD is actively mining Bitcoin, or that they're going to start mining Bitcoin for national security or just for energy resources?
I don't know. I think, honestly, people talk about this, and I think there are sort of people who look at the DOD space and make surmise. I don't know. I've not heard that from a credible source. I've seen some of the reporting and heard the rumors about it. Until I think we see that from a credible source, and I also think if they're gonna, is it possible that like an experimental, experimental environment, that DOD is running ASIC somewhere just for, I think that's very possible. But I think if DOD is going to do it at scale, if the intent is to impact, to have a sort of a national security impact, you have to do it at scale, right? Like you need to be the size of like a publicly traded mine to do that. And I don't know that they'd be able to hide that. And I don't know that they could do that, without a lot of fanfare and prep. Just cause you got to buy the computers, you got to get the talent, you got to get the space, you got to get the power, right? There's a lot that goes into it. And for DOD to sort of, I'm skeptical now, right now, only because I just haven't heard any sort of informed sources tell me this, that the U.S. government's going to start mining at scale. Again, on an experimental basis, they're probably doing it somewhere. All kinds of things are going on an experimental basis. But I don't know. I can't say. I'd be surprised. Again, when you think about like how Jason Lowry describes a hash force, that's like big scale, right? That's like duty has to acquire one of the public traded miners to do that. I think it's a,
let's pull on that right there. What about the U.S. government? They created this sovereign wealth, fund. What if they just went to Marathon and said, hey, we're just going to acquire you and you're going to be your hash force and we're going to acquire Bitcoin. Is that a possibility at all?
I think it's certainly possible and reasonable that if the sovereign wealth fund is established, that Bitcoin miners will be part of that. But I think it's equally probable you'll get TikTok, right? And as part of the sovereign wealth fund and all kinds of other things. I don't know. I mean, I do think that I think there is interest in Washington to make sure that the hash rate is controlled by U.S. companies. And a lot of the sort of miners, especially the small miners, people sort of out their fringes working to sort of find new energy sources abroad, are making a case that like, I can have miners running in wherever, Namibia, but that Bitcoin is American. It's going to my custody when I mine it. And it belongs to an American company. So I think there's definitely receptivity to that message. People are sort of understand how it works. Just because the ASICs in a certain country does not mean that country necessarily controls the product of that mining. I don't know. I think though, that larger discussion about how the U.S. government is going to dip its toe into Bitcoin mining, I think is also probably a 2.0 discussion. I just don't think that there's the bench of knowledge to get that sort of like across the finish line from a policy perspective, then to implement it.
That's understandable. What are the odds that Lummis's bill gets passed within this year? I know that, you know, late last week they said that they had 7 co-sponsors, and then a couple of days later they had additional 5. So I think that the 12 co-sponsors, both in the Senate and the House. What odds do you put it? Do you put it greater than 50% that bill gets passed within a year or even in this presidential term?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I feel pretty good. I mean, I'm up on the Hill a couple of days a week talking to staffers. both parties, their members are interested. They want to know what this is all about and how it benefits not just the country, but their own states, their own districts. So I it's hard to put a number on it, right? But there's a lot of momentum behind it, and we're getting a lot of interest and as I kind of referenced before, we're getting really good educated questions about what the impact of this bill would be, both to the government's balance sheet, but also to our global posture. It's hard to say. I think it's greater than 50%. Actually, I do. I try to be honest with myself. Maybe it's because I do it all day long and I'm talking to people all day long about it. I leave meetings and, they tend to, okay, Ken, thank you for coming. We appreciate your time. But I do think there are, I've been around, I'm not stupid. If I sort of reflect on sort of the specificity of questions and the homework people have obviously done, and these are offices again that I've talked to before, and just we're not kind of tracking the level of specificity in the homework that these offices have done on this issue leads me to believe that there's serious interest on that in the kind of that what I reference is that vast middle of lawmakers who just have been ambivalent about the space up until now. So that gives me confidence. This is why a lot of my talk to people, a lot of like tell them the heck my help is these people got to call their members, they got to call their senators, and in a very nice way, explain to them why as a constituent I support this bill and encourage them to to play part of the democratic process. But I feel pretty good, and it's only because I've seen definitely these offices are starting to bring their A game in terms of research and thoughtfulness about the issue, which is great.
Well, that's good to hear. One last question on this before we take a break for our partners. Do you know when it's going to come to a vote or when it's going to be brought up where it can be openly discussed? Do you have a time frame?
I don't. I think we should anticipate subcommittee hearings probably pretty soon. But I don't know. But I think within the next few weeks, I think you'll start seeing initial debate about it.
That's good to go. Good to know.
With Congress, things happen, and there's that's like kind of predicting the price of Bitcoin. When's it going to hit the floor for a vote? But I think there's a push, and I think I expect next few weeks you'll start seeing debate.
Well, that's good. I look forward to seeing some of those headlines come out. I do want to say thank you to our partners, though. Solo Satoshi, open source Bitcoin mining at solosatoshi.com. Use our code BTC Vets. Hey, Ken, I'm going to get you just to mute yourself real quick. Thank you. Use our code BTC Vets for 5% off your order. Pay with Bitcoin, and there's an additional 10% off. Solosatoshi.com. Punch plate. Stamp your seed phrase on a metal plate. Do not type it into your computer. Do not leave it on paper. Go to punchplate.com. Get that taken care of right now. Paladin Tower Tactics. Professional firearms and tactical training. PaladinTowerTactics.com. They will be leading a course on July 2nd at the Bitcoin Alaska Conference. This conference is in Juneau. It is a family-friendly conference. Conference dates for the conference itself are July 5th and 6th. Pre-conference activities take place on the 1st all the way through the 6th. So make sure you bring your spouse, your kids, make a trip out of it. If you've never been to Alaska, I am telling you, it is gorgeous in the summer. Feel free to get a one-way ticket because you're going to be hard-pressed to come back down south. And last but not least, Cold Card. Store your own keys. There is no excuse for you to leave your coins on exchange. It's not too hard. You memorize 12 or 24 words. Get yourself an MK4 or a Cold Card Q. Use our link in the Nest. Remember, not your keys, not your coins. Go ahead and get that taken care of. Okay, so Ken, I got a question for you. I'm not really sure if you will have an answer on this, but I'm going to fire it away anyways. Bitbonds, what are your thoughts on them? Do you think that they will play an important role in this administration, or is it just kind of a talking point amongst hardcore Bitcoiners?
So I would encourage all of you to go to our YouTube channel and find the discussion by Andrew Hones from New Market Capital, who presented at our conference on March 11th on Bitbonds. It's a really tight brief. It's a really tight presentation, about 10, 15 minutes long slides. And he does a really, really great job at kind of condensing for non-financial audiences the advantages of Bitbonds. So I think he lays a great foundation for the discussion. So again, I encourage everyone to go find that presentation. It's short, and you'll walk away with a really good understanding of what the impact of these can be. I don't know that Bitbonds are a this Congress topic, just because the nature of the calendar. I think SBR is going to be sort of the big Bitcoin event of this particular Congress. But I do think that the general idea of Bitbonds is gaining attention. Right now, again, admittedly, I think it's kind of on the edges of policymakers in the budget space, but I do think people are paying attention to it. Because ultimately, again, people are looking for ways. There's a lot of Washington's very unsettled now, just candidly with what's going on with Doge, budgets, and it just is. And I think once we get through this transition period of the new administration, I think there's going to be some really hard thinking about how do we actually manage the budget in a way that doesn't blow out interest rates, but also, you know, lowers the cost of financing. And I think that there are right now, again, it's a relatively new concept. It's kind of edgy with policymakers. We're thinking through what things we can do. There are in government, there are some smart people who do red teaming ideas, red teams to think through creative ideas of how to tackle certain problems. And I think financing the budget is one of them. So I do think that there are people in the fiscal policy space who are thinking through ideas of how to actually manage the budget in an affordable way. And Bitbonds, they're thinking about Bitbonds. This is why, again, I encourage people, and I even lawmakers or regulators have asked me. I send them the link to Andrew's presentation because just again, it's so tight and well done. I don't personally think it's something we're going to see discussed legislatively this year. I think there's probably too much going on. But I do think once we get through this budget cycle, what we need is for these, like everything, even with SBR, right? It takes time for these sort of new edge ideas to marinate in sort of the policy consciousness in Washington. That process has definitely started. Do we see it coming as a serious proposal in 2025? I don't think so. Probably not. But maybe on the horizon. Yeah, I think so. And I think a lot of it's tied to the success of the SBR. I think it's perfectly reasonable. There are a lot of Bitcoiners who are skeptical of the SBR. It's a fair discussion, like among friends, like should the government do it or not do it? I think honest people can have opinions on both sides of the issue. But my core point to them is there's a lot of concern about how the government will corrupt Bitcoin if it owns it and what does that mean for consensus and development of the protocol and mining and OFAC and all these sorts of things you all are probably familiar with. But my counterpoint has always been though, like if you really believe in the incentives of how Bitcoin changes people's incentives, right? Once Bitcoin's in the system, right, Bitcoin's hard to change. And my contention is once people are exposed to those incentives and they take root in government, those incentives will ultimately change behavior. I think as individuals, a lot of us can talk, have our own personal experiences, about how Bitcoin has changed our own incentives and how we view the world. Michael Saylor certainly has a very compelling story about how Bitcoin has changed his incentives and how he views the world. And more companies are doing the same thing. And ultimately, you know, the government is a big unwieldy beast, but you know, it is ultimately, you know, it's still humans, you know, acting on their incentives. So I actually think that once Bitcoin takes root in the collective consciousness of how the government functions, it's going to change those people's incentives, just by virtue of its presence. That's what I believe. And maybe it's silly just because I changed, that this Washington DC is going to change. But ultimately, you know, this is it. If we believe that hyper Bitcoinization and adoption will change incentives, then we have to, I mean, the U.S. government really is like sort of like the prize, right? Like if we can change the government's incentives, think of the benefits that would bring to the United States. So that's, again, I think it's perfectly fair for people to be skeptical. My view, again, I've been in the city for a long time, is that Bitcoin actually will, over time, change the incentives of lawmakers and policymakers. That remains to be seen. But I think that getting over this SBR hump is an important first step. And then I think it's actually an easier slide to integrate Bitcoin into other aspects of the system. And financing debt is an obvious next choice.
Yeah, I think you're correct on that. I do think that there's going to be serious conversations about BitBonds in this fiscal year or in this year, not fiscal year. So I think Q3 of this year, Q4 of this year, you'll see serious debates about whether we should implement or not. And I do think that's going to be tied to Bitcoin price. I think we're about to start ripping. I think that the bull market hasn't started, and you know, in the summertime, you're going to start seeing Bitcoin hitting all new highs, all time highs, and it's just going to keep going. And I think the timing on that is almost perfect, because you're planting the seed right now with all these lawmakers, and they're seeing it. They saw it go to 110, and now it's down in the 80s, and now they're just going to kind of continue to watch it, and then they're going to see it increase, and you're going to start seeing companies like MicroStrategy, their net worth, just because they hold so much, is just going to increase. And I think it's going to make a stronger case for creating the SBR, but also to go ahead and reduce the deficit with the interest payments, to go ahead and issue a 1% Bitcoin bond, and then just have a Bitcoin kicker on it to go ahead and offset that. And you free up a lot of space on that balance sheet. So I think that this year we will see some serious conversations take place with it. Again, I could be wrong though.
No, your lips to God's ears. No, I think we'll see more discussion about it. I agree with you. It's all, it is what it is. Price matters. But it's also a function of how smoothly the SBR is adopted. And I think Bitcoin Act will ultimately be adopted. And how smooth that transition is. And then you'll see immediate impacts on the balance sheet, right? To your point about price. Even the what's called 200,000, Bitcoin the U.S. government owns now. You know, if all of a sudden Bitcoin is trading at $180,000 at the end of the year, right? That's a nice kiss to the balance sheet.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're getting to the top of the hour. I had one last question, and then I'll again, if anyone's in the audience that has a question, feel free to request to come up here and ask. If you're a little bit shy, go ahead and just put your question in the comment box below, and I'll go ahead and ask Ken. But are there any, outside of the Lummis bill, is there any legislation or regulatory actions that we as Bitcoiners should be focusing on?
So there's a lot of discussion right now. The CFTC, the Commodities Futures Trading Commission, are holding panels about digital assets. SEC has a crypto task force. Bitcoin's not a security, but obviously publicly traded companies manage it. So there is a lot of sort of knowledge sharing and seeking, and I think it's great that both these commissions have done that. And they're being, frankly, quite transparent. And companies that are asking to participate and to provide input are getting good responses. So also, again, those of you who are who own companies or you know, feel you have something to contribute, I would definitely suggest reaching out to the SEC task force and CFTC task forces to provide comment, whether it's as part of a meeting with their officials or just written comment. This is these companies' efforts to sort of undo the excesses of the last administration and to find ways to facilitate adoption of not just Bitcoin, but for better or for worse, for other crypto products across the U.S. economy. So I think that the big victories are going to be on the regulatory side this year. And these are small victories that most people don't see, but have long lasting impacts that really ripple across years. Just as some of the negative things that the last administration did rippled for years, these changes will ripple across the industry for years to come, in a positive way. So again, I think it's worth watching what CFTC and SEC are doing on their public comments, and their task force. They do publish notes. They're interesting reading, and I think it's just a refreshing change. It's been incredibly transparent, and I've been impressed. Like, we've had small companies reach out to us and ask to participate. Tell them just here's the email. Send them an email and ask to comment. And they're getting great reception. Thank you for commenting. Or we're having a public hearing on this day. You're welcome to participate. So just that change alone, that regulators are actually accepting comments and accepting feedback from the industry, is a huge change, and will just necessarily result in better regulations.
Well, perfect. So Kent, is there anything else you'd like to go ahead and leave us with? And then what's the best way we can support you and Bitcoin Policy Institute?
Yeah. So again, I would encourage, it's really important. And I know this sounds, it's easy to be sort of cynical about it, but when you write polite, well-worded letters to your representatives, they take that feedback, right? Especially in election years coming up, and 2026 is going to be probably a very contentious election year, certainly in Congress. So it's really, really important that every Bitcoiner sends a nice, politely worded email to their senator, to their congressman, and explains, I'm a Bitcoiner, and this is why I think you should support the SBR, and whatever else that is important to you. Very, very important. I also think, certainly on the congressional side, if you have a good-sized Bitcoin meetup, right, if you can draw 10, 20 people to your meetups routinely, you know, there's nothing wrong with reaching out to that office and saying, you might not get the member of Congress to come, but you probably get a staffer to come, and have them attend your Bitcoin meetup, meet them. At least then you have a name, and it ripples, especially in these House races. Cause if you look at, like, in competitive House districts, we're talking like that, literally thousands of votes separating. I mean, like 2,000-3,000 votes separating some of these races. So if they can get in front of a sympathetic group of people who are motivated, maybe even have, you know, some spare change in their pocket, you're going to get interest. So I think Bitcoin meetups in places where you can get a dozen or so people, to invite a member of Congress to come, and nothing else outside staffer, which is, it may not feel as good, but probably almost as good, because these are the ones who are providing input to the members and formulating their perspectives on different bills. Really, it's worth doing. I encourage people to do that all the time. It's very, very effective. It's of course, for members of Congress, it's just a little more local, but there's nothing also wrong with inviting your U.S. senator to a Bitcoin meetup as well, because you never know, especially in election year. So I would encourage people to do that. For Bitcoin Policy Institute, I really just follow our work. Please comment on it, repost it, share it with your friends. This has been, again, I've been here for 4 weeks, and it's been just sort of, it's been a tornado of activity, but, our focus really is on foundational work. The sprints are great. You get a good buzz out of it, but it's the foundational work. It's the meetings every day. It's creating sort of a drumbeat of steady messaging to people that we are a community, we have influence, and yeah, also that we're well-intentioned. So please follow our work. Retweet it, repost it, comment on it, whatever your preferred platform is. And then I'll also highlight that we do have our policy summit coming up in June, Washington D.C. The summit on March 11th was a little smaller, a little faster put together to take advantage of the momentum from the SBR. But June is our annual summit, and it's a long event. We have members of Congress that's coming up, so stay tuned for information on that. That's going to be in late June.
Well, that's excellent. So if you haven't done it yet, I'm asking everybody who's listening to this, go into the Nest, click on the Bitcoin Policy Institute link right there and give them a follow. Also give Ken a follow as well. And make sure that we're supporting this work. Again, if we want Bitcoin to go ahead and be what we want it to be, to change the world in a positive way, it starts with us. Like Ken said, go out there, create a small little meetup, and use that momentum to start making local changes, and those local changes become a national change. So Ken, I want to thank you so much for joining us again. Open invitation to come back anytime. I really enjoy these conversations and getting insider information of what's going on.
Yeah, likewise, Colvin. Always a pleasure. It's great to see everybody. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you for coming on. So if you are new here, we do this every Monday through Friday at 10 a.m. Eastern time. If you are a veteran or a non-veteran or just someone who likes to just pop into the space, I'm still going to encourage you to go to our Bitcoin Veterans website, bitcoinveterans.org. click on that connect form. No, we're not trying to solicit your information. We're trying to get you to join our groups. We have a vast group of knowledgeable people about every facet of Bitcoin, whether it's mining, wallets, you name it. We have a group dedicated for you. And again, you don't have to be a veteran to join this. So please go to bitcoinveterans.org, fill out the connect form, get in touch with us. We'll get you in touch with the right groups, answer any questions we have. And again, just be part of this. If we want to change the world, it starts with us on a local level. It doesn't work top down, it's bottom up. So I will see you all tomorrow morning at 10 a.m. Again, thank you so much, Ken. Thank you for everybody who tuned in. It means a lot to me. But whatever you do, do not shitcoin. It's like trying to light a candle in the middle of a hurricane.